This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith here with Seth Friederman.
Good evening.
And Lisa Maria Redondo.
Happy summer.
And we're here with the designer Yoli Tang. Hi, Yoli.
Hello.
How are you?
Really good.
Yeah? It's really hot outside.
Brutal.
Yeah. You've been in New York fashion since 1981, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. That's a long time to be in this business. You must have seen a lot.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to seeing even more.
Okay. We've got Fashion Week coming up in less than a month. Are you doing a presentation or a show?
Well, Fashion Week is a bit of a myth, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, in the beginning, I was on the board of 7th on 6th. So I showed in Bryant Park loyally for a long time. But after 9/11, I decided that the world had changed. So I've done a lot of disruptive shows, including one on the subway station underneath Bryant Park. It's the BD station. And I had, it was September, brutally hot, and I had 30 women. So what we did was we got them into my loft, which is on 35th Street, hair and makeup, dressed them, got the coldest bus we could get. We bused them to the train station, and the transit authority was celebrating their 100th anniversary. So they gave us, they printed my invitation on one ride of the MetroCard. So the girls went down and swiped and walked the longest runway from 40th to 42nd Street, and the trains were going, and everybody was sweating, and my PR people at the end of the show were soaked from here to pants wet.
That's your urban nomad.
Yes, one of them. And the touching moment was when Farrah Fawcett said, "I've never been on the subway."
Oh, that's great.
That's amazing.
It was wonderful. And I don't know if any of you remember Elsa Clench.
Sure, of course.
That was a question I had for you. That's how I learned about you. And it was very emotional for me that I wanted to say that today, because my first fashion teacher was Elsa. And I watched her when I was like a kid in college. And she was so loyal to you and loved you so much. She never missed a show of yours.
That's true.
She spoke so articulately and effusively about what you did. And I've known you since then. And I've been a fan, of course. So what do you think about Elsa? Like,
well,
do you miss her as much as I do?
She opened that show. So when she walked down the subway platform, well, it wasn't a platform, it's the walk, what do you call that area upstairs?
Oh, you're talking about where the turnstiles are?
The mezzanine.
When she walked down, all the photographers were saying, "Hey, Elsa, hello," and all that. They didn't realize she opened the show.
Oh, my God, that's so cool.
Yeah, I think Elsa Clench and that show were, you know, along with Tim Blanks, were a lot of people's introduction to fashion. And they gave such an intelligent window, you know, because they were both, with Tim still, of course, so capable of describing things in a way and why it matters and explaining to people why it's special, which is something I think a lot of the press now doesn't do, or doesn't, maybe the editors are saying that people aren't interested in that anymore or whatever, but they sort of demystified it without making it less special.
Well, they did their homework.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're, and the press now doesn't really do their homework.
No.
Unless they're WWD, and they're amazing.
Yes, this is true.
Yeah.
Elsa was the gold standard. I have sort of a question in that area. It might have been your first collection or very early collection, you did like a capsule of five pieces that were all in black. Correct me if I'm wrong, one size fits all. And they were snatched up really fast by Bergdorf's, is that right?
Yes, it was five easy pieces.
Uh-huh.
It was a jacket, a top, a pant, a skirt, and a coat. And the coat was a one-size-fits-all cape.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness for that, because I took it to Bergdorf's. They bought 200 pieces, like, snap. And I was thinking, oh, gee, you know, I'm going to have to cut it all myself.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily, it was a one-size-fits-all, so I didn't have, like, six different sizes to cut. I just had one. I just had to stack it, like, maybe I made three piles, but I had a schoolmate help me, and we cut it to the flight of the bumblebee.
What do you think about department stores now, and the buyers who sort of are supposed to be creating, curating what's there, compared to what you experienced in those early days? And what do you think of it now?
I have a question for all of you. What do you think of fashion today? I mean, that's really a very potent question, because
I have concerns. We have a lot of concerns.
Can
about
we go around and you define what you think?
Sure. My biggest concerns right now, when we were sort of talking about it before the show, and through my work with clients, I work with a lot of brands, is again that if you don't have large amounts of cash, and you don't have a large amount of industry internal connections, that it is extremely difficult for you to get off the ground. And people, I think a lot of people were expecting e-commerce to sort of even the playing field, and it has to a certain extent, but because of the way the factory systems are set up now with the scale and minimums and what the pricing is and what it does to the margins for the young designers, it's not really helping as much as it could have or it should have. So I worry that we're losing way too much talent. I've watched so many talented designers come out of Parsons and SCAD and RISD, London College of Art, and Cordwainers for shoes, or anywhere around the world, and make incredible, interesting, beautiful, intricate, talented stuff, and they don't make it, and it hurts.
Lisa?
I think fashion is falling into the same paradigm that we're seeing in other areas like economy, where you have a tiny little bit at the top that's kind of eating all from the top of the food chain. And then in the middle, it's difficult to figure out how to be there. And then there are these, fast fashion retailers who really kind of propagate a kind of offense to humanity and an offense to creativity in a way. And I think it's very difficult to navigate where you might fit as a consumer in that scope. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't have the money to buy clothing that is humanely made and is creative and comes from a place of freedom and all of that, where it's a very slippery slope until you find yourself standing in Zara. And I think it's something that we're seeing that with, the 2% versus everyone else. The middle class is taking a pounding and the people at the very bottom are asked to pay for everything, and I think it's kind of unconscionable that the powers that be have created a situation where the poor in first world countries prey upon the poor in third world countries and have this strange interchange, how they're helping each other, kind of, yet they're kind of at the mercy of something else and someone else who's got way too much. So there's a sort of political problem with fashion. And I think that there's a correction that needs to happen where people have to start to understand that it's better to buy one thing every 3 years that's decent and good and wonderful and going to last you for a long time than it is to constantly feed this like emptiness and hunger by $3 t-shirts and $8 sandals mm-hmm. that were made by some kid somewhere. And I didn't really know about that. I bought that stuff. I remember when that stuff was available and it seemed like democratic, like, hey, I can afford something nice too. And through doing this podcast, I've learned I can't do that anymore. And I'm just waiting and hoping that there are ways that there are creative solutions, because I love when people look great.
I think the word that comes to mind when I think of fashion is perversion, and not in the sexual sense, but in the sense of perversion is an act that is carried out without love, and I think that happens in fashion every day.
Give me an example.
If you make someone a shirt and you aren't making it so that it is covering them and making them feel good and protecting them, you're just making it to exploit the person that is going to buy it, mm-hmm. then that's a perversion of the act of making something. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really rampant in fashion, and that we should really be acting with love and with intent to be good more than we are.
Wow.
So that's why we're really thrilled you're here, because a lot of things that we believe in, you've held the banner for since 1981.
Oh, or longer, perhaps.
Oh, maybe.
I think that the, you know, I really truly believe that the zero waste is a philosophy, and it's not about saving fabrics by the yard or by the piece. It really is, you know, when you practice zero waste, the most important thing that you can save is your own time and other people's time. And you are zero waste by being organized with your time. You get to work, you know what you have to get done, you do it quickly and efficiently, and you don't waste anything. So I have a lot of students who come to work with me because we have a fellowship at Parsons, and a lot of them are attracted to my work, but it really begins with how they conduct themselves in their own manner, with their own time. You know, when the kids go uptown to do an errand, they're supposed to call before they come back to 29th Street. That's saving time. But, you know, some of them forget. And I think that in many, many respects, all of us can improve everything by just being aware of what it is that we do not utilize to the full. That said, right, it applies to everything, but it also applies to your clothing. Why buy something that you can't wear forever?
That certainly used to be, pardon the pun, woven into the ethos of companies, not just because it is good and decent and sustainable and mindful, but because it is part of building a company that you can then pass on to your children and their children and their children. I think of some of the great legacy brands. No, I'm not talking about Chanel's. I'm talking about stuff like Carhartt. Mm-hmm. Or Shot, you know, here in New York, where
Arrow shirts.
Yeah, Arrow's another one, where the whole idea was, let's build a high quality product and sell it for the best price that we can give our customer, and build, you know, and build loyalty and have people come back and go, well, I'll take 5 more of those, and I'll take 3 more of those, and oh, I like that new color you've brought out. But it was about an ongoing relationship, and it was about building a company that you could, that was generational. That, you know, we were hoping would last for 600 years or 800 years.
What's that idea of the Craftsman tools from Sears?
Yeah.
That they have a lifetime guarantee on a hammer, and they don't really limit the lifetime. If you ever bring in a mangled hammer to Sears, they will replace it with a new Craftsman hammer.
I worked for Sears.
You know, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
so
there's a couple of companies that have that. And the reason that Sears can do that and could do that for years was that they had a contract. It's a bit of a digression, but I think it actually does go to the point. They had a company in Colorado Springs, Colorado, called Western Forge. And what Western Forge would do is Craftsman would ship all of the damaged steel products to Western Forge, and they would take out anything that wasn't metal, like the rubber handle or whatever, and that would be disposed of. But the metal, they would simply melt down and reforge. And they would lose a percentage every time they did it, but it wasn't a significant percentage. And that's why they could offer that lifetime guarantee. And other companies had the same business model and premise. Husky, I think, did lifetime warranty for a while too.
I don't think they do it with things with motors in.
No, they don't.
But it's like a hammer or a wrench.
Something that's forged. Yeah, that was the whole
solid
idea.
Solid forged. Yeah.
And there were companies that had that too. I mean, L.L. Bean, you know, and Dexter.
And people definitely take advantage of L.L. Bean's policies.
Yeah, yeah.
But what is the core fault policy?
It was that if you bought an LL, I don't know if it's limited to certain products, but I grew up with a lot of LL Bean, like turtlenecks. Uh-huh. If you bought an LL Bean turtleneck and it wore out, you would ship it back to them and they'd ship you a new one in the same color.
Wow.
Yeah.
That model is on the run a little bit because the customer doesn't want something. There are too many customers, sadly, that don't want something that lasts. They want something new every few minutes. And that's, to me...
It depends on the customer.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think that's the prevailing thinking. New. Replace.
Right. Disposable.
There are people, I dare say, like us, that we value what we own and they last for a long time.
Yeah.
And we're not the exception. We should be the rule.
That's what we have to work towards, or else the planet isn't, it's not, I mean, you just can't keep making all this stuff and pulling it out of the planet. It's too much water, it's too much waste, it's just can't be done. It will hit the wall one day. I don't know what that day is. But.
And I think, too, you have to be careful who is telling you what the definitions are in this industry, because there's this sort of, well, this is what the consumer wants, and so that we're just giving them what they want, without acknowledging that the consumer has been trained to want that, and therefore they can probably be untrained, you know? Like, there's an economic equation that Lisa identified before where we've got the squeeze on, so people are really buying $6 shirts because that's what they can afford, and that's a separate issue. But the idea of less but better, mm-hmm. I think is still very much alive, but the people that run the marketing and the people that run the seasons and the campaigns and the runways and they're continuing to do that because it lines their pockets. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be careful who is telling you that this is the way the world is, because they may want it that way because it's benefiting them. And I think there's a lot of that in fashion.
Well, I don't know how you awaken the consumer, but the consumer decides. That is the way it works. They vote with every dollar, and Mr. Zara, whatever his first name is, will go away if people don't buy that anymore. It's just the way it will be.
I have an anecdote that's connected to what you're just saying. Mm-hmm. Nanette and I did a talk at the New York Historical Society, and it was chaired by Joanne Olion, who's curator of the Museum of the City of New York for a long time. And the audience was largely made out of union workers. Yeah. So at a certain point, when the conversation drew to an end and it was open to Q&A, they demanded to know why Nanette and I didn't bring more work home. And I had to say, excuse me, ladies, you're the ones that can bring the work home. It's based on how you consume. You continue to buy cheap, it'll never come home. Mm-hmm. You have to pay for something that's worthwhile and worth its value. And I didn't get very much acknowledgement back, but it really is true.
I so agree.
You know, it's like all of you that are sitting in the audience, if you go over to Target or wherever you shop and you demand to see what they have for you that's made in the USA, and you do it constantly, it could make a difference. But only by the numbers. You know, if two people do it, forget about it.
I just feel that a lot of consumers sort of, I always think of The Wizard of Oz, where she goes through this incredible journey that's mostly difficult, and at the end they say, well, yeah, I had the way home the whole time. It was on your feet. The whole time, the solution was right there. And I really think consumers don't understand they have that power. They see these titans, they see these organizations, and they feel powerless and weak and exhausted. And they don't really understand that it really is them. It's those dollars. And if enough people recognize that and come together.
Well, wait a minute. If the only store that sells clothing in your town is Walmart, how do you communicate to the fashion industry that you want more Made in USA clothing?
I'm trying to think of what that town is. Is there really a town
like
that?
Oh, sure.
There's a lot of
them.
Because there's always a goodwill as well. I mean, there's always
shop. If you have three children, you can't shop at Goodwill. You're not going to get the sizing.
That's possible.
And they're going to keep growing through stuff. And
I don't know.
And again,
too,
there's the economic trap, right? If you're making just enough to keep a roof and food in your children's stomach, you know, and even if you're a two-income family, which is not always the case, then you're trapped. They've got you trapped. And then we go back to that perversion of the people making shirts for 6 cents, 8 cents, the purchasing manager somewhere in a corporate tower here in the United States or elsewhere, signing off on that, knowing exactly what that means for the life of the person who's making the shirts, for 100 shirts a day for 6 cents, and then charging $6, $10, $12 to the person who that literally is all they can afford. When you're participating in a rigged system, but it's the only system that you can participate in, I don't know how you excise yourself from that system. If you have the ability to make conscious choices, then that's a different story. But if you don't, I don't think it's fair to lay anything on them.
I agree, but for many town USA, there are choices.
Yeah.
There are definitely choices, and they're and intelligent people can make them. Also, and ingenious people can make them.
I kind of see your point, though. Yeah. For some people, it's no choice.
Sure.
You know, it's, there's no opportunity for choices to be made.
We interviewed a woman who's got a workshop where she was making,
in
New Mexico, and she described neighborhoods and areas that she was servicing with this wonderful
Native American population.
Where they can't even get in the car and go anywhere because it's muddy that day. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely pockets of America that really almost function like third world. Mm-hmm. But by and large.
But fashion is in the manus machina
realm. Yeah. The one thing I will say, though, that's interesting is, if you go back to our parents, well, pretty much our grandparents' generation, or when our parents were young, the solution that the poor had in those days was they sewed.
Exactly. Or knitted.
Yeah, and they don't do that, and people don't do that anymore.
Well, it's not cost-effective for their time.
No, right. And it
with
would be on top
fashion,
of a 60-hour work week that you're going to go home and make clothes for your children. That's not possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Mark Rico. I'm one of the hosts of Fashion Is Your Business, a podcast about technology and business in the fashion industry with industry leaders and icons and next big thing innovators like Andrew Rosen of Theory, Mazdak Rossi of Milk Studios and Made Fashion Week, Deborah Lloyd of Kate Spade, and even the chief of staff of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, talking about what's important to you. We have a great time on the show, and we think you will too. So please join our conversation on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or at our website, fashionisyourbusiness.com. Thanks.
I was at a panel discussion the other night at FIT. They have a corridor that's been has portraits of designers who do low-waste design and eco-fashion, responsible design, ethical fashion, I guess is the overall term. And I think it's called Humans Who Design.
Oh, I saw something about that.
Yeah.
Is this still up?
Yeah, the portraits are up until September, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's in the side of FIT where the amphitheater is, not the museum. And so I was at this panel, and at the end they asked if anybody had any questions, and I got up and spoke a little bit. They'd been saying throughout the panel that it was about consumer education and that this problem can only be really solved through consumer education. You can do as much as you can as a designer, but unless the consumers know to buy it, then it doesn't work. But they were all small businesses, and they were talking about small and medium businesses. And I got up and asked the question, where the hell is the CFDA? Because they could organize a campaign within a month to educate the American consumers about ethical fashion. And they have not. They have not taken that leap. They could get all the department stores together, put something on national television, and get Americans to wake up. But they just haven't acted. And I don't know why. I don't understand why they haven't organized this sort of thing.
There's a number of practices, commonly accepted practices in the industry, that I wish the CFDA would speak up about in general, or any of the organizing or global bodies in fashion. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one of them. I think the chargebacks issue for designers is one of them, the fact that
the CFDA is looking after the retailers, not the designers.
Well, it certainly seems that way.
What do you think, Yoli? You've had some experience
with them. No
comment.
Fair enough.
It speaks volumes. It's really not interesting for me to speculate about what people are trying to do, because I feel that all of us should just step up to the plate and take responsibility for what we do and for what the people we know do. It's like concentric circles. You do what you do, you affect three people around you, they affect another three. And, you know, because when you look at it at the scale that this discussion was embracing, it's almost mind-boggling. You know, how are you going to affect change? But change starts here. There's four of us.
Right.
So that's what I vote for.
And it starts with your company, and it starts with your connection to the garment district and your community that you've
upheld.
You would
be surprised, or you may not be surprised at how smart the women are that come into my store. Mm. I don't have to tell them anything. They know.
Mm.
They know what looks good on them. They know the value of what they're buying. They know how long it'll last. They know how many places they can wear them to. They know it travels well. They know they can hand wash it. There are people that I could inform, but there are a lot more that could inform me.
Hmm.
I think my greatest joy is when I see a stranger come into the store and I watch what they go to try on first. It's always an eye-opener. You were about to say something.
I was wondering about this thing that you've said in the past that clothes have magic. How does that play into your work?
Oh, they truly do. It's the full quote is clothes have magic, their geometry forms shapes that mm-hmm. can lend a wearer power.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that, you think about the church and how tall the hats are.
Mm-hmm.
You think about headdresses, you think about cloaks. Clothes do lend magic to people. And it, from the beginning to the end, I mean, I'll never forget when Annie Leibovitz had that show at the Brooklyn Museum of her work.
Mm-hmm.
I got quite a few phone calls about having to get my ass over to Brooklyn. So I did, and I looked at the pictures, and lo and behold, there were many beautiful photographs, but one of the labels said, and it was about Susan Sontag and her illness, and the label said, and you may have heard me say this before, so forgive me if I repeat this, but one of the labels said that when Susan passed away, you know, the hospital gowns are really very dehumanizing, but
mm-hmm.
so when she passed away, Annie went and looked for her favorite things, and she buried Susan Sontag in her favorite Yoli coat. And till death, we do not part.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say that people wear my clothes to death, that has
kidding.
A lot of meaning.
Wow, what a way to go into the next world, in a Yoli coat.
That says something too about not just the symbolic power, which you were mentioning before with the Catholic Church and the mitres and, you know, Napoleonic era headdresses and cloaks and, mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. shoulder pads and mm-hmm. all of that, but the inward radiating power.
Yes, at peace.
Right, that comes from wearing something that you feel expresses you without edit
mm-hmm.
in an honest way, where you're like, if somebody gets the message of what I'm wearing, they will know me, you know, and not in an artifice way, mm-hmm. but in a genuine way.
I think for women, I'm not saying it's not true for men also, but women who have sort of undergone foot binding and waist binding and all kinds of, you know, neck elongation to sort of fit into some thought of how they're supposed to look, what their beauty is, to make that woman comfortable now in modern times and to let the beauty come out of that comfort is, I think, I know it's something you're committed to. I wonder, are there other people that came before you that you feel sort of paved the way, maybe Chanel or anyone who thought that same way about freeing the woman's body and making her powerful?
I'm sure, but Chanel certainly does not come to mind.
Oh, really?
No. I think that, no.
But you do have some heroes. I know that you're a lover of Halston, is that right?
Vionnet?
Oh, Vionnet.
Vionnet was uh-huh. just, it was just about beauty.
Mm-hmm.
But have you seen her patterns?
Mm-mm.
They're pretty amazing.
I don't understand patterns. They're absolutely, I was bad at math.
But I think
But
that,
I respect.
I think that countless others, Claire McCardle,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
freedom, women, sportswear,
sure.
mm-hmm.
movement,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
There are countless artists, designers
mm-hmm.
that paved the way for me and future generations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can't name them all, but they're ever present and their influence is felt. there are a lot of unsung women designers. And the person you really should speak to is Patricia Mears. She's curator at the Fashion Institute of Technology. She's actually the assistant director, but she's very well schooled. And she did a book called American Beauty that's worth, you know, run over there and buy it because it talks about Anne Fogarty and all the women designers that were basically unsung. You know, it's a, here's my favorite, we'll go back to Elsa. Elsa supported a whole cadre of women designers more than any other editor before or after. She has. And when you look around right now, you know, the, I think the first ad that, no, the first cover of the CFDA magazine maybe had 10 guys on the cover.
Yeah.
That's a weird magazine.
That's the, what we're talking about.
I only looked at the cover, so I can't.
Let's go back to no
comment. But, you know, I was flabbergasted.
What do you think your biggest strength is as a designer? What parts of being a fashion designer do you hit the strongest yourself? And what parts do you have to have a team around you to execute?
I think compassion plays a role. You know, a lot of women are forgotten in the fashion world. I dress everybody. I have no prejudice. So I think that the women that like my what I do and they appreciate my work, they see that immediately, that I thought of them. And I think that you cannot make clothes for people if you don't care about them. And I care about my clients very, very much, and they know it.
I meant more in a technical sense.
But I love that answer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great answer. But,
you meant in a technical sense?
In a technical sense, as a designer, which parts are you the strongest at executing, and which parts do you need help from your team to finish the project?
I think probably I do very many different things. Like I sketch, I drape, I make patterns from scratch. I make muslins, but I don't assemble the clothes. Mm-hmm. I could, but I just don't have the time. So I think that the hands that make the clothes are what I value a lot. And, you know, it's not just sewing. Pressing is just as important, if not more so, than sewing.
We heard that from tailors when we in one of our very early episodes, that the application of heat to the material was one of their best ways of creating a shape.
And also you can ruin it terribly if somebody presses your something wrong, it's done, it's finished. So
I had a tailor when I started. He had retired from working with Calvin Klein and he came to work for me, and I have all his tools, including this like big wooden stick that you hit your sleeve with after you set it in the armhole. You beat it with a stick after you steam it. It's so cute. But
the episode that Charles was referencing, if I'm remembering correctly, the two tailors we had on, Mac and Alex, I think, where that was, were concerned that that sort of tool set, that education was in shorter and shorter supply. And I hear that a lot from designers in the industry, that they get, I know one designer in particular told me that he got very frustrated with not being able to find the lace workers that he needed and having to go to France to get the lace done, and, you know, that sort of thing. Again, is that something that is correctable? Can we, as an industry, start initiatives where we're picking people and saying we'll train you to, you know, for free to do this so that we don't lose it?
You know, I think FIT has a program. Andrew Ward helps with it, where they actually train people to sew and cut. I don't know the details of it because I haven't participated actively.
But it's outside of the confines of the regular education program. It's more aimed towards the general public.
I think it's sort of like, I don't think it's an apprenticeship, but it's a class.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think it's very helpful. But I wanted to go back to your question because I don't feel like I answered it completely. I think, though, in every part of the process, there's always somebody that can do it really well or better. like I can drape my ideas because it comes from my head and it's very difficult for people to interpret. My pattern maker will say to me, oh, you go make it because you know what it's supposed to look like. But she improves on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you're not, you know, you don't do, no man's an island, no woman too.
Ralph Rucci said something very similar about the toiliste being the person who breathes life into the clothes.
Well, it's what I'm trying to say, though, is that every step of the way that I pointed out, there's always a skilled person that does it for a living that can do it a lot better with more care and more patience. And you're as good as your team.
Yeah. And you've had, do you have really long-standing relationships with all those folks?
Yes, I do. That's some of them, not all of them.
Hmm. Are you from New York City?
No.
Where are you from?
Guess. One guess.
Akron, Ohio.
I know. Well, I kind of know. Are you from Malaysia or are you from
yes.
China?
Yes.
Malaysia.
Okay.
Oh. Right. Which part of Malaysia?
Georgetown, Penang, Malaysia.
Mm. Okay.
It's actually Pulau Pinang. Mm.
So how have you blended those roots with now who you are as a New Yorker and as a creative person? Like, how does that past inform who you are and what you do?
You know, it's hard today to, like, think about those things, but I remember saying in the past that I came from, you know, a tropical country, so it really freed me up to be very inventive about coats. And one of the things that I was enormously successful with was coats, because I had no preconceived notions.
You had a longing for them.
Yeah, I didn't know what navy meant. I mean, there's a connotation about navy and white shoes and all that stuff. And when I came from Malaysia, I had no idea. I didn't know how to dress for the winter. Mm. I didn't know that you were supposed to have a scarf, a hat, gloves. I was used to running around in shorts and a t-shirt.
Barefoot.
Yeah, pretty much.
You tend to make seasonless clothes. What is your approach to having something be seasonless?
Less waste. Wear it all the time. Right. I'm sorry. I'll try and answer that. ask me the question again.
It's really hot outside right now, and in the winter it's really cold, so how do you make something that works for both winter and the middle of summer? How do you make something that is seasonless?
Well, what you select as a fabrication is important,
okay.
But the interstitial space between you and your skin and the other skin that you're wearing, how much air is between them, also makes a difference. I think that there are lots of things to consider, but I've done a lot of clothes that are seasonless. And the late Richard Martin, he coined the term the fifth season for the clothes I make because he truly understood he understood my work in a very profound way. And he could explain to me, I couldn't think this way, that my one-size-fits-all clothing was commensurate to an architect's paradigm of a room.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not mine. I'm quoting him because I couldn't come up with that statement. But making clothes that you can wear all year round is easy because it's what I wear. I wear my clothes all year round. Like, I'll wear this in the winter. I'm wearing it in the summer. It's cotton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like breaking down barriers and rules. I just really hate fashion rules because they don't make any sense. Well, at least to me.
Speaking of that, young designer sitting in the room, right? Let's say somebody who's a season in or just getting started. What rules would you tell them to throw out the window immediately that they're going to get preached to? That they're going to
just do what you want. That's it. You know, people are going to fill your heads with don't do this, don't do that, do this, do that. Make up your own mind. Think for yourself. Look around. Watch and learn. People tell you what they need all the time. I mean, I hear it all the time.
I was going to say, your clothes, we know, are made in New York, but it sort of feels to me, seeing them all these years, that they're made for New York, too. They really, they're connected with this place. They're connected with living here in this environment. And I guess they fit other urban environments. I don't have a good question here, but how do you figure out that relationship? And how does it speak to a woman who maybe lives in the suburbs or in the country?
You know, I don't think like that far with that many solutions. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm like the Martian, you know. You said do the math, solve the first problem. That's how I work. You know, I want to make something, okay, a pair of pants. I want to make it that a pair of pants that everybody can wear from size 2 to size 18. Mm-hmm. And, you know, forget it if you work for a fashion house. I mean, you can't talk about a size 10. Forget about a size 16, right? But those people are people. They need clothes, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the inherent prejudice in our industry that I feel is very unkind. Mm-hmm. You know, somehow if you are beyond a certain size, you are invisible. Now, how can you be? You're so big, right? Everybody should be able to see you.
Certainly at a certain age, that gets more and more true as well for women. And I think that when you speak about clothes that have magic, I think that's a really wonderful thing to give a woman who's maybe of size or of age, because they're easily overlooked in the environment. I don't know why that is, but it's true.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's when you talk about clothes having magic, I think about the pair of pants that I referred to, where I saw a size 2 come in and put it on and leave with it on. Mm-hmm. And it goes all the way up to a 12 and a 14. And I've gotten special orders for size 0. And the same pant, I got a special order for a 00, which I've never made in my life. I didn't know people came that tiny. So I don't know, I can't, probably there's no like specific way to explain something that is magical because of numbers and proportion. You know, it's almost like a sixth sense about how things work on people. And it's really not just the clothes, it's who you are in the clothes, it's how you move in them, and it's how they affect you in how you think and how you feel. Mm-hmm. Now I swear that if you put on something that feels right, feels really good, it immediately gives you confidence.
Okay.
And absolutely. If you can move gracefully in them, it gives you authority. So close to lend wearer's power.
It's like sitting down and meditating for 20 minutes. I think it changes you on a molecular level. I really do. I think suddenly your posture changes. Who knows what else changes? I think it's beyond our understanding. That's where I think you're right about it being magic.
Yeah. I think it's just before we leave the issue of body, of the wonderful variation of female and male bodies. That is always one of the joys I get in watching the Olympics, which are on right now as this episode is being taped, of watching these magnificent young and now somewhat middle-aged women, which I think is great, and men. And because of the demands and rigors of their sport or their particular activity, their bodies are a certain way. And it's a bit of chicken and the egg, where they had that type of body, so they went into that type of sport, but then that body also was developed more in that direction because of the sport. So I watched a woman win a bronze medal today in powerlifting, and she looks like a powerlifter. She's magnificent. But yet I know, and it saddens me a little, I know that this industry, which I love, and the designers that I love, they don't have a connection between her and my industry.
She's going to have trouble buying clothes.
Yeah, she's always going to. And it's just sort of, and I've been trying to forge for years, and a lot of our listeners have heard me talk about this, so forgive me, but a connection between female athletes of all shapes and sizes and all different types of sports and our industry, because I really feel it would be a way for us as an industry to sort of point the way forward towards you're magnificent and don't let anybody tell you because you don't look like a runway model that you're not magnificent, you know? But I have had absolutely no success whatsoever.
The obsession about Michelle Obama's arms is ridiculous.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
In terms of people loving them or
no, they
or
don't
wanting
don't like
not
them.
Wanting to see them.
They don't like them. That she has muscles.
They don't. Yeah.
Oh really?
Yeah, they don't.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who say that she looks unladylike. But they've leveled the same charge against Serena. I'm like, you know what she does for a living? I don't understand like why you would level that criticism.
I was when you mentioned the Olympics, my mind wandered to that article in the Times about how gay men like watching the Olympics. Did you guys see
it? Yeah, I looked at it. I didn't read the article. I
didn't read it either. I was like, whoa, where's that coming from?
Yeah, it is. It's our culture has very weird ideas about beauty and appropriateness and then fashion connecting with them. It makes me uncomfortable so often.
But the great thing that I think we're getting from what Yoli said is that like if it's a great fabric, if it's cut, draped, constructed, if it has that architecture, then it's democratic. It's going to flatter so many different people and make all of those people feel good with it on. And I think that's a kind of thing that only comes with experience. I don't know that young designers are uncannily good at that from the very start.
Oh, some are.
Somewhere.
There's always somebody out there that's like
a Mozart.
Really, no, it's you know, you have to have faith.
Yeah.
There's a genius lurking about everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, that goes back to your original question to us that I answered was, I'm worried that we forced some of those people out of the business. There are people who should be in this business right now who I've watched.
No,
quit.
You don't. I won't say the strong survive.
I know that.
And you know, listen, you better fight back if you want to live. Now, I wanted to go back to your original question about department stores.
Oh,
where were you going with that?
I was just curious to know, because I sort of think of the old days of Hollywood and the way producers used to really be creative and be able to just take a risk and take a jump because they saw something great in somebody and they went with it. And then the film business became very corporate and I won't go into it, but they don't take those same risks, let's just say that. And I'm wondering, you know, when you were coming up in the 80s, was there still a flavor of that where there were buyers and people who ran those fabulous stores who just really had a wonderful vision for that store and created a magical place almost?
You know the greats. It was Don Mello, Joan Kaner, Geraldine Stutz, Gene Rosenberg, Neiman Marcus. Mm-hmm. What's his name?
Which?
The...
Oh, Stanley.
Right.
I mean, they were the retail greats.
Right.
But that was a different time, you know, and they understood their time, the time that they were in really well and could function extremely well within those confines. Today, we're in a world that's very hard to define. So.
When I was in film school the second time, I had a class called the Executive Suite, which was with Russell Williams, who won the Academy Award for doing the sound for Glory. And
Glory?
I think
the
also...
The Civil War film?
I think also Dances with
Morgan
Wolves.
Morgan Freeman.
Mm-hmm. He was a... Well, he did sound location sound
Denzel,
recording.
Denzel won the Oscar.
Yeah, I think Denzel.
I think for field mixing, he won the Academy Award. But he had this class that he kind of designed where he introduced us to other people in the executive suite of the film industry. So we'd have teleconferences with people in Los Angeles, and it was very interesting, but one of the people he brought in was a producer, and the guy said, I'm tired of geniuses, I just want people who get the work done. And I didn't connect with that at all, because, I mean, if you're in the business of making creative things, wouldn't you be looking for the people who are the best at making the creative things? And he was looking for boring people who can be a technician and just get the work not done and not be exceptional. I don't know.
Well, maybe he thought of himself as the genius and he needed minions to get the job done.
Maybe.
I mean, I don't know who you're speaking of, but depends on your perspective and context.
But I think that we have that a lot today with corporate culture, where people don't want risk takers. They only want to get that little bit ahead that they have to satisfy a quota. Mm-hmm. And once that's resolved, they want it stabilized so they don't have to have a bigger quota the next time around. They don't want real success.
But
they
Charles,
don't want to take those leaps.
Don't you think that on the whole, Americans are a bit docile?
Are we? Yeah, we're a little docile lately.
I mean, I think that, present time, okay?
Yeah.
But I think that there's a lot, well, not all of them are, because the Boney movement was very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, I think that we can't, not that any of us are complaining, but nobody can complain, you know, you should just go out and act. Take responsibility, do things. Don't sit there and complain.
It's always
not
more
you.
Complicated.
Okay.
in terms of,
yeah.
You know, people have to live, like if you have children, you know, whether it goes back to the consumer we were talking about before, or whether or not you're a creative painter, sculptor, architect, photographer, dancer, or if you run a dance company or whatever, if you have children and mouths to feed and a family or other responsibilities, you have to satisfy those responsibilities. That becomes the greater goal in your life, and I think in a beautiful and very just way that's correct. So it's difficult, I think, particularly now when everybody's under so much economic pressure, or more people are under economic pressure than it were, say, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, to find that way to be creative. And so to fault somebody for being too safe, well, maybe correct, I think it's understandable to a certain extent that it's impossible to, or not impossible, but that it's scarier than it would have been to take a risk, because it's not just your apartment or rent or the car payment or whatever that's riding on it, it's food in your children's mouth or whatever. So you have to be careful about, or I feel like we have to be careful about assigning blame or saying, well, people need to be more of this or less of that. That said, I will say, going back to the one thing that Yehoi Lee has said a couple of times, which I find to be a rallying cry, and that is, if all of us thought of ourselves as having that sphere of influence, right, where I have friends that I see every day or talk to every day, and if I took it on myself to say, how can I make that person's life better today, now, tomorrow, and they did that for me, and somebody else did it for them, and so forth and so on, and then we interconnected, that maybe we would create safer spaces, maybe we would create a better environment where people could say, you know, I am going to work on my screenplay tonight after my kid goes to sleep, or I am going to not give up on trying to be an art photographer or a professional photographer or a sculptor, even though I've got my 9-to-5 job and I'm not too tired, where I won't cave into that I'm too tired, because I feel a little supported, I feel a little loved, people are saying my work is good, and sometimes that can be enough to keep people going, you know. Certainly, I've had those moments where people were like, I believe in you.
We're sitting not far from a community that always created that. I mean, those Garmentos were in competition with one another, but they helped each other, too.
Yes,
they gave each
they
other
did.
Tips.
Yeah. They did.
Shared information.
They really did.
And the talking was like the old school internet, and from it, they thrived. And then their children became doctors and lawyers.
Well,
and
right.
They created New York society in many ways.
I hope that what I said has not been misconstrued. I wasn't saying that people don't do enough. I think people do a lot. But the thing is that everybody should believe that they can make a difference, was what I was trying to say.
I so agree.
You know, you can make a difference. You know, going back to the Garmentos, and I think that I'm used up a lot of your time.
Not at all.
When we started on Made in Midtown and Making Midtown, mm-hmm. which was, you know, my partner and I wrote the RFP for those studies. Mm. And when we did that in the beginning, there was no conversation yet in 2007 and 2008 about locally made in New York, factories, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I got into it because I got a flyer that said that there was a talk that the EDC was giving about changing the zoning in the garment district. And I went, and it was full of like shop owners, some of whom barely spoke English. And there was a guy doing a presentation. This is your industry, and this is the trend.
That was a downward line for the people who can't see.
Thank you, Charles. And that meeting initiated everything for me, because it was like a rallying cry. I sat there and I looked around me and I realized that all the people that were sitting there, more than half of them, it would cost them their jobs. And then you look around, you know, I was on 35th Street, and you see all these tall buildings, and you know that there are, you know, five Asian women at lunchtime cooking their rice, putting their sandwich under their iron. What were they gonna do? And I think that that takes us right back to today. And I have a big question, which is that in the beginning, when they sent all those jobs overseas, whether it's garment workers or auto workers, who thought about what the people whose jobs were being given away going to do for a living? And was there ever a consideration when the jobs were sent overseas for what was to come for the people who gave them up or got them wrested from them?
Am I just the worst person in the world by thinking that there's almost like a conspiracy against those people? They just need to go away and die. there's no consideration for them. They must fight for themselves, otherwise, because nobody cares.
I know some of them, and they didn't realize that no one else would hire those people.
Right.
They thought, well, I'm going to get rid of my employees in New York City. Someone else will hire them, and I'm going to produce overseas and get away with getting cheaper clothing.
I actually watched some of the conversations on C-SPAN in the 90s for the NAFTA hearings, when the select group of senators from both sides of the aisles and congressmen from both and women from both sides of the aisles, along with the Clinton administration, were drafting NAFTA. And there were people who mentioned that. There were people who said, what about the person in Flint, Michigan? What
right.
And not just the person. What is going to happen to the town in West Virginia, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, in Kentucky, in Missouri?
I was in Detroit. I went to Detroit to see what was happening in Detroit.
And there were people who said this, and not only did they say what's going to happen to those people, there were people who put on presentations before both houses, because it was subcommittees, and said, this is what's going to happen to those people, because it's happened before. Historically, it had happened in other places in the world where they had seen the effects of when an industry collapses, this is what happens. And in the previous historical cases, I remember one gentleman, I wish I could remember his name, one gentleman was speaking specifically about the HVAC industry, heating, cooling, air conditioning, things like that, about historically speaking, what had happened when industries collapsed in the past was that it had happened fairly slowly. And so that there had been a little bit of generational time, well, the jobs aren't here anymore, so you might not want to have your son or your daughter go into this industry, right? And so the impact then on, say, somebody who was hand-making something that had been industrialized was lessened. People moved, there was migration, but there was time. But what was being proposed by NAFTA, and then later CAFTA, and now TPP, happens in the number of months, because as soon as the company gets licensed, the corporation gets licensed to move the work, they do it immediately. It's all set up ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And so there's no time to adjust. So you end up with this incredibly disenfranchised population that literally goes to work one day and there's no work there. And that there was the impact was going to be devastating, and it was going to last for generations.
And they did it anyway. You have a faction that loved Bernie, and you have a faction that loves Trump because that's the heritage of those people.
Yeah.
Whether they were people who built the Brooklyn Bridge and got dumped when all of that kind of work went away, because this isn't the first round of this. It happens all the time when a workforce is no longer needed. The powers that be, that's not their consideration.
So I'm waiting for the next candidate to come along that will say, this is what we're going to do, guys, when the robots come.
Yeah.
They're already here.
Retraining.
Right. That is a huge concern. Yeah. There's so many people who are going to lose their jobs to automation.
I know.
Oh, yes.
I think it would be interesting to hear more about what the plans are to take care of the people whose jobs get displaced.
Yeah, a lot of it is about retraining, but when the robots get better at doing things that we do by hand.
Oh, they already do better, right?
Well, not everything. I mean,
right.
It's pretty
Correct.
Hard for robots to make complicated clothing.
They can walk up and down the stairs. They cannot. Not yet.
Yeah. Elevate, elevate.
But they won't need to because they'll build the building so that there are shaft ways where they can move. You know what I mean? Like there are ways around that. And so then maybe the jobs become about building better robots and people go into that. There's also an overpopulation problem, which is part of this issue as well, is that there are too many people. And as a species, historically speaking, as a species, not meaning just us, I mean all species, like deer or frogs or whatever, when there's an overpopulation problem, Mother Nature has ways of taking care of that, and they're not pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think it's really important to just be in a community of some kind. I think it's a form of protection. I, as you said, all of these issues we're discussing, whether it's creativity or survival, you cannot do alone anymore. You really need others, and you need the ingenuity of others, the sport, the wherewithal.
And you need people to make clothes for.
That's right.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Well,
that's right.
I hope you continue to make clothes forever and ever. Usually.
And people who can afford your clothing.
Yes.
Which...
When I go, I want to have your coat on.
If they have jobs, then they can afford your clothing. If they don't have jobs, then we have a problem. So we have to figure out how to make sure that people have jobs in the future. Yoli, thank you for coming and talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It was really nice to speak with Charles, Lisa, and Seth.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Yoli.
And enlightening.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the American Fashion Podcast. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher, and we really appreciate when you leave us a good review there. We also love getting mail, and you can contact us podcast@fashionmediacenter.com or leave comments and questions on our voicemail line at 646-979-8709. We're also on Twitter at AFPOD and on Instagram at American Fashion Show. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Fashion Media Center LLC. All rights reserved.